From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Next week, the new Michigan legislature meets. One political observer expects this will mean politics gets nudged a little farther to the right.
It's going to be a more conservative Republican caucus. And people might say, boy, how can you get more conservative than what they've exhibited in the past few years?
Then John U. Bacon stops by for a quick update on the future of Western Michigan University's football coach. We'll talk with a biologist who is among those scientists who believe we're documenting the Earth's sixth mass extinction. And we'll hear about another area in Michigan where the water is being contaminated, this time by firefighting chemicals used at a now closed Air Force base.
Back then, there had no way of knowing that these were actually leaching into the groundwater.
And a few observations about what kind of mates people choose today versus in the past. But first, let's get a news update. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. The new Michigan legislature convenes for its first day of session next Wednesday. Here to talk about that is Ken Sikkema. He's senior policy fellow at Public Sector Consultants and a former Republican legislative leader. He joins us by Skype. Ken, first, there's a new Speaker of the House, Tom Leonard. He's 35 years old, Republican from DeWitt Charter Township in Clinton County, just north of Lansing. Term limits mean just about the point people in this state know the speaker's name, we get a new one. So what do we know about Speaker Leonard?
Well, that's true, Lester. In fact, every 2 years, the House, and that's what we're talking about here, has a pretty significant turnover. You not only have a new speaker here, but probably 40-some new House members. I think every indication is that it's going to actually be a little bit more conservative, even though Republicans kept their significant control. It's going to be a more conservative Republican caucus, but time will tell. They need to take some time. He's appointed a policy committee. They'll have a policy retreat to talk about their priorities and agenda, and that's gonna take a little time. He's gonna need to kind of assess the new membership and then proceed.
According to a Detroit News report I was looking at, Leonard listed his three top priorities. There are mental health reform, training for skilled trades, and fixing the state's broken teacher retirement system. That mental health reform caught me. This is about people in prison. He's talking about the cost of that. So what do you think mental health reform would really mean? What would that look like?
Well, the whole issue of criminal justice reform and, you know, the idea of this sort of mental health reform is part of that because a lot of people in state prisons have mental health issues. Conservatives, surprisingly, have exercised some leadership on this in the past, and all indications are that Speaker Leonard wants to continue that. And it's really kind of part of the core conservative philosophy that taxpayer expenditures, when it comes to government, need to have good outcomes. You know, you just shouldn't throw money at problems. In our prison system, in the last few decades, that's basically what we've done, is just thrown money at the problem of criminal justice, and conservatives are taking a brand new look at that. So I think people need to see that as a positive here. But like I said, it's surprising, I think, to a lot of people that conservatives want to take these issues on.
Why? Why do you say that? Why surprising?
Well, I think it's surprising because people would normally assume, well, progressives or liberals are going to be concerned about the people in our prisons with mental health issues. You know, it sounds compassionate. And in that sense, people say, well, liberals would want to champion that. But no, actually, in this case, I think conservatives look at it from the standpoint of it's not just a human issue, which it is. Not just a compassionate issue, which it is, but it's also kind of a taxpayer issue. You know, these people are languishing in our prisons, and that doesn't make sense from a taxpayer outcome standpoint.
And the cost, as I understand it, is about three times higher than a typical inmate for somebody who has mental health issues and is incarcerated. Let's move across the aisle and talk about leadership there. Representative Sam Singh from East Lansing will lead the Democrats in the House. What's his leadership style like?
Well, I met Sam in the past, and he has political experience. I think not only as a state representative in the past, but I think he's former mayor of the city of East Lansing. But he's very policy-oriented, quite cerebral, is how I would characterize him. He's not going to be a wallflower. You know, he'll challenge Republicans. I think in part because we're entering a gubernatorial election season, and that's going to help energize Democrats across the across the board. Every indication is that he'll cooperate where he thinks he can, but he's not going to be a wallflower here. He's going to challenge Republicans.
You talk about the Republicans going on a retreat to try to figure out what their big policy issues are. Do you have any expectations of what we'll see?
I think it's going to be a more conservative Republican caucus. And people might say, boy, I don't know, how can you get more conservative than what they've exhibited in the past few years? But these new House members in primaries, conservatives tend to get elected in Republican primaries. And I think Tom Leonard himself has acknowledged that it's probably going to be more conservative. But time will tell.
So are we talking about social issues rather than state budgetary issues? I mean, what kind of items do you think we'll see?
I was thinking primarily of budget issues, tax issues, not so much the social issues. Taking a look at government programs and actually asking some pretty significant questions about, you know, is this program worthwhile? Should we keep it? And of course, on the tax side, there's going to be a great, great reluctance and antipathy to any kind of tax increase.
It's barely 2017, and we already have an announced candidate for the 2018 elections for governor. Gretchen Whitmer, a Democrat, a former legislator, announced this week. So what's the strategy in this early announcement like this?
Well, in her case, because she doesn't hold elective office currently, it makes sense. So she can get around the state, get some attention.
Well, she is Ingham. I mean, she wasn't elected, but she was appointed Ingham County prosecutor, correct?
Yes, but that ended here at the end of the year. So it's different than if you're a Bill Schuette or a Brian Kelly. You're going to get publicity and attention because in the case of Schuette, he's the sitting attorney general and Brian Kelly, the sitting lieutenant governor. Dan Kildee on the Democratic side, if he becomes a candidate, he's a sitting congressman. They're all going to get some attention because they currently hold elective office. In her case, she doesn't. So I just think it makes sense for her to get out early. And I would add, this is a big state. You got to raise a lot of money to run statewide, and it allows her to begin raising money.
You kind of anticipated my next question. I was going to ask you, who are the other Democrats? You mentioned Dan Kildee from Flint. He's a current U.S. Congress member. So are there other Democrats on the horizons we might see coming up as a candidate for governor?
I couldn't name them, but I think you will see more. I mean, we all kind of in the sort of political chattering class, we all kind of name the same names. But there's always going to be surprises. And on the Republican side, even though Brian Kelly and Bill Schuette get most of the mention as potential candidates, just the fact that we mentioned both of those sort of allows an opening for a more conservative candidate to decide to run, because they can look at it and say, well, these two candidates might divide up the vote. And the more conservative Republican, the kind that promoted Donald Trump and supported Trump, they might gravitate toward a more conservative candidate. So I think you're going to see a candidate of that political stripe emerge on the Republican side.
We've already seen Bill Schuette distance himself from Governor Snyder. They're not buddies, let's put it that way. But Brian Kelly is attached to the governor just by office. He was his running mate. You think both of those candidates will distance themselves from the Snyder legacy, or will Kelly embrace it and say, hey, here are the positive things that Governor Snyder has done?
Brian Kelly, the sitting lieutenant governor, is a very likable person. He's a smart person, policy oriented, but it's impossible for him to distance himself from the Snyder administration. It just isn't possible. And it's one of the big challenges any sitting lieutenant governor historically has had in Michigan. They have not been very successful. If you look over the last 30 years, there's very few sitting lieutenant governors who had ambitions to be governor that were successful. And it's simply because of that. You know, you have the legacy of a sitting administration, and people just get kind of tired of that. And then you have the Flynn issue as part of it. So that's his biggest challenge. Nothing against him. He's likable and he's smart, but he's kind of running against history.
That is Ken Sikkema. He is senior policy fellow at Public Sector Consultants. Hey, Happy New Year to you.
Lester, Happy New Year to you. Thank you.
Thank you. Joining me now is John U. Bacon, sports commentator for Michigan Radio. And you're going to tell us a little bit about the Western Michigan University football coach's future. What happened?
P.J. Fleck is the guy's name. He's only 35 years old. Clearly one heck of a coach. Brought a dormant Western Michigan team up to 13-1, undefeated going into the only one outside of Alabama. Undefeated team going into the bowl games. Played Wisconsin in the Cotton Bowl, by far the biggest bowl game in Western's history. They lose it. And then they announce that he is going to Minnesota to coach the Minnesota Gophers next year.
Now, the Gophers. I don't know too many coaches out of the Minnesota program. What's that going to do for his career?
There is a reason, Lester, that you don't. You can go back 50 years. A once proud program in the 30s and even the 50s. Minnesota is now one of the Big Ten's graveyards, frankly, and no one leaves this program alive. So I think P.J. Fleck has made a big mistake.
Well, he's going to be making more money, no doubt.
As mistakes go, he'll be fine.
Yeah. So what's this do for Western's program? The Broncos did really well this year, as you mentioned, and even the Cotton Bowl game was a really good game, I'm told.
It was.
So the program is where it's at. They're going to have to find a coach really fast. But is it all coaching, or is it just a good lineup, a good recruitment?
The answer is yes. Coach, no question about it. Put together a great lineup. And he is smart, I will say this, to leave Western. Love it, though I do. That if he had stayed, it's probably not wise. They're not going to go 13-1 next year, no matter who's the head coach. So as a man named Billy Shakespeare said, there's a tie to the affairs of men. So it's time for him to leave, but not to Minnesota. My strong hunch is they'll take somebody off Fleck staff to make him the head coach of Western. They're going to be fine next year, I believe. Sustainability is always a problem with any program, and time will tell about that one. But I think right now P.J. Fleck has cashed in, but he will not cash out.
Okay, that's John U. Bacon. He's Michigan Radio Sports Commentator. Thanks for coming in and giving us an update.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside on Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham. We could be on the cusp of learning a lot more about the native cultures that inhabited Michigan before European settlement. A researcher at the University of New Hampshire is using technology to find Native American cash pits. Megan Howie joins us now. So first of all, what's a cash pit?
Okay, a cash pit is...
And we sing C-A-C-H-E.
Yeah, not, cash. Yeah. Like cash, like cash your savings. It's essentially, it's a subterranean, like underground dugout storage pit. You would dig kind of a storage pit. Native peoples would use kind of the earth as a refrigeration technique. Dig these kind of, you know, 3-4 feet deep kind of holes. Circular kind of holes, line them with birch bark, which is amazing, has these amazing kind of properties of keeping mold away, keeping dampness away, and then fill it with their food products, potentially other kind of daily use products that as they moved through their kind of seasonal rounds of hunting, gathering, and farming, and come back to these storage pits. So they're essentially old-fashioned refrigeration techniques, you know, kind of storage places. So
now, these are not uncommon, but they're hard to find because they're so old and they've
yes.
been filled in and everything else.
Yes.
So you've found some in the past, but recently you found a lot more. Tell us about
yeah.
that.
So these are quite common, but they're very hard to find because they dug them and then they took the stuff out and exactly they filled in over time because they're several thousand years old. 800 to 1,000 years old, so they filled in over time, and now they're just kind of these shallow pits, especially in wooded areas, quite shallow, small kind of circular depressions. And I've spent several years working up around Douglas and Burt Lake in northern Michigan looking for cache pits and then trying to find sites people were living at associated with them. And after 8 years of walking the woods, we found 69 cache pit clusters. Feeling pretty good about this, you know, and the clusters will have sometimes hundreds of cache pits. So, but then we got the chance to work with LIDAR,
which I should probably explain.
LIDAR data. The state of Michigan is actually trying to fly LIDAR for the whole state. They have a program. LIDAR essentially sends pulses of lasers to create surface models of the earth, and it'll penetrate through vegetation. It's pretty amazing technology. It's attached to planes, and they fly, and it creates these very detailed models of the Earth's surface, the terrain.
So it's like topographic
maps of very high resolution, but the power of it is it penetrates through vegetation canopy because it has these lasers. So you get much better models of the Earth than previous methods. So they were flying this for the state, not for archaeological purposes, but we got the chance, some early access to this LIDAR data from the region around Douglas and Burt Lake, where the University of Michigan Biological Station's housed. And when we worked with it through some pretty complex kind of computer modeling work, we were able to find cache pits. We used the ones I knew where they were to prove that we could find them. And then we ran it for the whole LIDAR data set we had. And 8 years, 69 cache bits. 1 week, we found 150 cache bits. So 1 week of LIDAR work.
Well, that's pretty efficient. Is this new technology? I mean, has this been used other places?
Yeah, it's used. I think what's really interesting about the work what we did with it is archaeologists have been using this in the big places you think of archaeology, which we tend not to really pay attention to in Michigan as much as I hope some of the work we've been doing tells us we should. And they've flown LIDAR a lot in Mayan areas, Angkor Wat and Cambodia, big societies, big sites in tropical forests. So it's been used, but it hasn't been used to find kind of the more subtle modifications from the past, like this kind of thing.
So you know where these are. Yeah. Do you actually excavate them?
Yeah, I have.
So tell us about what you might find.
Well, not much. That's the, if a good cache pit was a good cache pit, it stored the food and they took it out and they were empty. But what's interesting, so I did several excavations because you could see how they built them, which is pretty kind of amazing engineering feats in sand. They would, you can see the kind of choices they made about how to structure these so they would be stable in sandy soils. You find some evidence of the materials, like berry seeds, through very detailed analyses of the soils. You can tell a little bit what they stored in these berries, acorns, corn. You get very small remnants. So you don't find much, but you get a sense of the kind of amazing engineering ability that the pre-contact people had.
Imagining there might be pottery shards.
Sometimes.
Or something like that.
Rarely, because they would store things in pots so that if they broke on their way out. I do find them often on the edge of a cache pit. You'll find a couple broken pot shards. It's low density stuff, which makes sense because the point of storing is to take it away, right? So you wouldn't expect a lot of stuff left behind. So
a lot of Native American sites often have been destroyed. These are different because they're underground and people don't know that there's anything there. It's not like mounds that we find.
Yeah, and I've done a lot of work on mounds and earthworks, and those have been.
But you're still trying to keep it more or less secret where you've discovered these cache pits.
Yeah.
Why?
I think, it's really important cultural heritage. These are cultural heritage resources for the state of Michigan and for the tribal peoples who are the descendants of these. And while they don't have much in them, there's a lot of potential to learn more from them. And once you dig something up, it's gone forever. Even I limit my excavations because I know technology like this is improving. Once you dig it, it's non-renewable resource. Archaeological materials are gone once you take it out of the ground. And I think you can get, you should just be sensitive to the fact that these are non-renewable. These are sensitive sites. They reflect this great history and heritage that we have a lot to learn from. And if we kind of release where we find all of this stuff we find people did dig into them, like kind of looters, people that see these and do have some sense that they're archaeological. And you'll find that they'll dig down into them. And if you get that kind of damage, it just destroys that record,
Now, these are on the earth. You said they were 800 to 1,000 years old. How do you date something like that?
Yeah.
And was it just that 200-year period that these were fashionable? Did they change or did they continue to make these
later
centuries?
Great question. Dating these cache pits is somewhat hard, but from the work that has been done on them, they consistently show up around 1200 AD. There's a kind of fluorescence of this storage practice of the need to store your food, which is really interesting because it tells you a lot about the kind of social and economic life. Like, what is it that changes at 1200 AD that makes the communities need to store food suddenly at kind of much larger scale? That's a kind of cool anthropological question that I'm interested in. But so we know
agriculture, one assumes.
Agriculture has a big impact, but in this, essentially the rise of maize agriculture kind of precipitates this change. And even people who aren't growing corn, like in the area I work, there's not a lot of evidence of corn, are in response to those growing corn intensifying their own use of the wild resources. It sets into motion a kind of increase in economic activity. So they are using these in this late period. We know from the ones that have been excavated from their association with known late, this kind of 1200 AD sites, that people build them right up through contact, and historic Anishinaabe groups continue to build them through kind of the 1800s. So there's also this great ethnohistoric component where we know how they dug them and filled them because of that. And then they fell out of use.
Well, yeah. That's what I'm wondering. Why did they fall out of use?
I think modernization and development and, by the kind
of... So they were being built up to...
the 1800s, so
European
settlement. By historic groups. And historic Native Americans continue to build them. And actually, there's some great narratives of this guy, John Tanner, who was a captive. I put that in air quotes, which you can't see on the radio. But, you know, he ended up living with the Ojibwe groups in the Great Lakes. And he would rave about how efficient these storage pits were that they were building. This was in the 1700s. And he would say, what a great efficient method for storing your food over winter. They've really got it figured out compared to European storage methods where stuff is rotting all the time. So it's, I think, just modernization, reservation life, these kind of things changed the dynamics and ability. So
you've checked out this one area. Do you have plans to check out the entire state?
I have great desire. I want to do this for the whole state. Well, starting with the northern area where we know there's a lot more forest and chance of finding these. Yes, I have plans. I think as the LIDAR data becomes available for the whole state, my goal would be to do it for the whole state and beyond as LIDAR's flown in Wisconsin and other parts of the Great Lakes too. So Michigan's really pioneering this LIDAR flying for the state, and I hope to take great advantage of it. Yes, so...
That's Megan Howie. She's an associate professor of anthropology at the University of New Hampshire working in Michigan. Thanks very much for coming in and telling us about
this. Thanks. That's fun. Yeah.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. In a new paper, economists at Northwestern, the University of Michigan, and the Census Bureau looked at how the education levels of a person's parents, grandparents, and great-grandparents can predict their own education levels. Their analysis found that intergenerational mobility, social mobility, the chances you'll rise above your circumstances, was 20% lower than suggested by previous studies. In other words, equality is more persistent across generations than we thought. Joining us is one of the researchers who worked on that study, Catherine Massey. She's an assistant research scientist at the Population Study Center at the U of M. So what does this research show that goes beyond previous research on social mobility?
Well, a lot of the research that we're seeing in the economic and sociology world looks at really parent-to-child transmission of wealth, inequality more generally, income, and education attainment. And what our research really does is it extends it another generation or two backward to see if we don't include grandparents, how does that affect our understanding of social mobility more broadly?
Why that approach? Give me an example why that's better.
One really great way to think about just inequality and social mobility in general was proposed by Ross Chetty, and he has this analogy where he says, picture the income distribution as a ladder. And then intergenerational mobility is a measure of how likely a child is to go from their parent's step of the ladder to the next step of the ladder. And then inequality is a measure of how far away the steps are on the ladder. So if we think about how important that is, that the ability to go from one rung of the ladder to the next, if we're systematically understating our ability for our society, for children to move from one ladder to the next, that's going to have profound effects on how we conceptualize inequality and mobility in the country as a whole.
Well, I mean, we've always been told, you know, that our chances are good. If we pull up ourselves by our own bootstraps, that if we work hard, maybe a little luck, that we can attain just about anything. And this research shows not so fast.
That's right. I think there is this belief in America that we're able to tolerate some measure of inequality because there's belief that even if things are unequal, we'll be able to move ourselves up. But what we're finding is that it's really worse than we thought, that mobility is not as high in America today, and it really hasn't been getting any worse or better, but it's pretty high, and it's higher than we've previously thought it was.
Now, is this educational attainment? Is this family wealth? Is it a combination of the two? What did you specifically look at?
We specifically looked at education attainment, and we did this for several reasons. So a lot of times it's really difficult to observe parents and children, particularly the children when they're adults, because you don't want to observe their income when they're a 15-year-old living with their parent. You want to observe the child's income when they're older, their education is complete, and they're earning. Well, this gets really hard when you go further back in time. And when you're looking at grandparents' generations, the grandparents of today's children, you're really looking at the 1930s and 1940s. And data is really scarce at that point in time.
Sure. And you're going back as far as the great-grandparents, which makes it more difficult.
Right. So we're going all the way back to 1910. And when you're looking back that far, you have problems with how do you measure income? Is it measured accurately? is it measured at the same point in time for the parent and the child? So there's a literature that says it's important to try to measure income of the parents and the children when they're about the same age. Because you can imagine that on the parents, where they are in their life cycle, might be earning more. Like a 55-year-old man might earn more than a 35-year-old man, and that's true for the sons as well. So if we look at education, we don't have these constraints. Basically, your education is fixed by the time you're 25 years old, and it doesn't change much for most people for the rest of their lives. So this really eased that data constraint for us.
So I was reading in the Washington Post, which did a blog on your study, and it gave the example of there's a banker, makes good money. That banker's child decides, that's fine for him, but I'm going to be a poet. And then the grandchild, the son or daughter of that poet, says, I think I'm going to be a banker. So is there any benefit to the grandchild from the grandparent in your research?
Well, I'd certainly say that our research shows that in this case, if you only looked at the parent and child, this one little blip of the parent being a poet would definitely skew our understanding of mobility in the U.S. We don't research how the grandparents affect grandchildren. Those channels we've left for future research. But certainly you can imagine that that grandchild would benefit from the grandparents' social networks, their work networks, their own wealth and education.
We're really kind of in a place where all that hope and aspiration that we have, if we just do all the right things, we'll be okay. It sounds like your research says that's not necessarily the case in the majority of families.
It's an important caveat for the research that we're not really looking at causal explanations. We're just looking at the relationship, and we are finding a relationship for grandparents, and we don't know if it's because grandparents directly influence their grandchildren or if there are cultural or values that are passed on from one generation to the next. It could even be measurement error, but the fact that we're finding something for the grandparents says that mobility overall is lower than we thought it was.
I want to ask you about another study that was issued a couple of years ago, and it basically looked at the surnames of families. And it went back centuries to see what the status was of certain surnames then and through the centuries since and what they are now. And it came to kind of the same conclusion your research did. Families don't have that much social mobility. Are these apples and oranges or just a nice convenient coincidence for your study? Tell me about the two studies and compare them.
Well, the work that's been done on surnames is definitely groundbreaking. It's exciting research, but I think it looks more at what kind of wealth persistence is there across generations and how is that characterized by your surname. And in general, what we find is that persistence of wealth across families, that is quite a bit more persistent than if you look at income or if you look at education attainment. So Gregory Clark finds that it takes up to 10 generations for basically any advantage of your ancestors to wash out. What we're finding is it's closer to 5 to 6, but this is more than the research has found before that says that it takes about 4 to 5 generations.
This might be a separate issue, but with growing inequality between the very rich and the rest of us, how does your research fit into that?
I mean, these ideas are very intertwined. Of course, in America, I think there's this belief that we accept a little bit of inequality with the idea that with hard work, we can bring ourselves out of poverty. We can make a better life for ourselves. But if that's not really the case, then we need to examine policies that may enable a little bit more social mobility and reduce inequality.
That's Catherine Massey, an assistant research scientist at the Population Studies Center at the University of Michigan. She, along with Joseph Ferry at Northwestern University and Jonathan Rothbaum of the U.S. Census Bureau, just published new research that suggests social mobility, upward mobility, if you will, might be a little more limited than we've previously thought. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Paleontologists say fossil records show there have been 5 mass extinctions in the past 540 million years ago. A paper in Nature characterizes mass extinctions as times when the Earth loses more than 3/4 of its species in a relatively geologically short interval. Biologists now suggest that a 6th mass extinction might be underway. Joining us to talk about this is Johannes Fofopoulos. He's an associate professor at the School of Natural Resources and Environment at the University of Michigan. So what are scientists in the field, people like you, seeing that persuades you that we might be on the cusp of or actually in the midst of a 6th mass extinction?
Well, this is a complex question, but at this point, there are multiple lines of evidence from different parts of the world and using different kinds of scientific approaches, whether these are general estimates we're supposed to species counts that all are pointing in the same direction, which is we see a very consistent move towards decline in species richness, in populations, and eventually in species, which result eventually in species extinctions.
I want to ask you about the definition a little more. It indicates in a geologically short interval. So where do you start measuring something like that? I mean, do you go back to the woolly mammoths several millennia ago, or do you start a few centuries ago with hunting species to extinction or wiping out habitat? How do you measure it?
So basically what you see is you can start measuring, counting extinctions going back to the first expansion of human populations across the planet, arrival of Native Americans in the Americas maybe 13, 14,000 years ago. But you don't even have to go, and there are a lot of species that went extinct back then. The evidence at this point about these what we call Pleistocene extinctions is mixed. Some lines of evidence suggest that humans were responsible for that, hunting overkill basically. At the same time, the climate was changing. So it was probably one of these 1-2 punches where it was very hard for the large mammal populations to withstand the dual assaults. But the real big story is what's happening these days. So if you look at this pattern of human activities, you see this exponential increase in impact. And matching that is the number of extinctions. So what we're seeing is species going extinct at an accelerated rate. These days, there are probably thousands of species that go extinct every year.
Wow.
And part of this is we don't know a lot of these species. They haven't been formally described just because there aren't enough systematists and taxonomists around to actually catalog them. But just because we haven't described them doesn't mean they're not disappearing.
So it's been suggested that some of these previous mass extinctions have been because of, you know, huge asteroid strikes or a real quick shift in the Earth's climate. What are the causes of this sixth mass extinction that scientists believe we're seeing right now?
That answer is pretty simple. It's definitely humans who are responsible for this. Now, there are three or four different primary mechanisms. So there is climate change and ecosystem stress. There is overkill, overharvest, literally like killing animals, removing them from wild populations. There are invasive species, and the most important of all, habitat destruction.
What do you mean ecosystem stress? What factors into that?
So this is a general term that scientists use to describe a cluster of drivers of extinction that are not specifically tied to a location. So this is things like pollution, like endocrine disruptors. These are chemicals that mess with the physiology of vertebrates, for example. This includes nitrogen deposition, which is a global phenomenon that's impacting plant populations. So there's – and global climate change is one of them. And all of these are sort of like non-specific – not tied to specific location, and they're leading to species extinctions worldwide, even in areas that are very far away from humans per se.
So in what ways – give me some examples of how we're seeing this happen in Michigan.
In Michigan, the situation varies a little bit between the north and the south of the state. Habitats and ecosystems in the north of the state tend to be in pretty good shape.
Although they've been altered a lot over the last couple of centuries.
Absolutely. So they saw dramatic changes when all of the vast majority of the Michigan forests were clear-cut. That was huge trauma for the species communities. I would say, given that reality, the present impact of humans is relatively minor. I mean, it doesn't mean there aren't problems, for sure. Inappropriate forest practices are certainly an issue in areas of the UP. But I would say that the biggest problems we see in the southern half, southern third of the state, southeast Michigan, basically the areas where we see the highest human densities. In those areas, we have great problems because of habitat degradation, because of invasive species, because of development. So if you look at the way cities have expanded in the halo of suburbs around Detroit, it has been a lot of areas have been converted.
But have we seen extinctions in Michigan?
Yes, there are species that have disappeared, either that occurred only in the Great Lakes region and that have now completely disappeared. There are, for example, fish species that are gone, do not exist anymore. What we see more is species that have a distribution across the Midwest and that have now disappeared from Michigan. So there are various plant and animal species, most of them invertebrates, sometimes vertebrates. A good example would be passenger pigeons, for example. Passenger pigeons used to be the most common bird species in this part of the world. There are flocks, there are hundreds of millions of birds big. They're amazing. There's nothing like that that exists today. And they were hunted to extinction. They are not the most common bird of that time in the 19th century is completely gone because of human activities.
I've covered projects where developers complain about regulations and restrictions. Their work is stopped by what they see as a minor wetland or some small fish or slug. Why does it matter if we lose some of these species that don't seem to be key to human survival?
Well, that's what people might think. But the problem is that research is increasingly demonstrating that we depend for proper ecological function and for appropriate ecosystem services to species we may not be aware of. Typical example is I had colleagues that 20 years ago were doing research on pollinators, and people thought that was very academic and very relevant. It turns out pollinators, bees, insects, flies, are extremely important for pollinating our crops. This is something we discovered in the last few years. What you see increasingly is farmers raising crops, having nice plants, and not being able to harvest any fruit because the plants don't set fruit because there are no pollinators. So these are ecosystem services that were being offered by invertebrates. We were unaware of them, but this doesn't mean they didn't do something that for us was is critical, is important.
So if I understand you, we've got this intricate interwoven web that we might depend on by 3 degrees, you know, away from us, but actually has some impact on our own lives. We just don't know how.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Or often the just because the link isn't obvious to us, there's a tremendous lack of knowledge, doesn't mean it's not important. It's the kind of thing where you really want to keep the pieces of the watch, so make sure you can actually reassemble it rather than losing some pieces and then suddenly realizing your watch isn't working anymore.
So I think anybody who has learned about this sixth mass extinction has got to be a little concerned. But then it comes down to, well, you know, I can't stop the smokestack industries from polluting. There's a lot of things I can't do. That's out of my hands. So what can someone do that they have control of, you know, in your own home, in your own backyard? What can we do?
Right. Couple of things. So I think one is make sure that we communicate to our representatives and the local politicians the importance for preserving local species communities, local habitats. Being a responsible citizen and participating in the political process is really important. Second, write letters, donate money to local conservation organizations, and try to live a green lifestyle. What does that mean? Use less energy. Try to commute shorter distances. Eat perhaps less meat. Red meat has a tremendous impact on the climate and on the land. These are all small things that we can do to reduce our footprint on the planet.
That's Johannes Fofopoulos. He's an associate professor of conservation biology and disease ecology at the School of Natural Resources and Environment at the University of Michigan. Johannes, it's good to see you again.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to be here.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. There's an irony in Michigan. We have water. We have access to lots of water. But as you know, Flint is struggling with its water supply. Ann Arbor is concerned about 1,4-dioxane in the groundwater surrounding the city. Dioxin in Midland, the oil spill in the Kalamazoo River. And now we're learning about another contamination in groundwater near Oscoda. The source looks to be the former Wurtsmith Air Force Base, which closed in 1993. Joining me now is Chuck LaShawn. He's the Deputy Health Officer and Environmental Health Director for a four-county area up there. The contaminants are perfluorinated chemicals, PFCs. Where do they come from?
Well, primarily they're used in the process of manufacturing certain items like
Teflon pans. They're not in the Teflon as a final stage, but in the manufacturing of them, in the case of the Air Force Base, Wurfsmith Air Force Base, they were used in the foams that are used to put out fires. And during training exercises, emergencies, these foams are used, and they've been using them probably since the 60s and since then. And, of course, back then there had no way of knowing that these were actually leaching into the groundwater. So they're used in the foams, and they're used for all fires on planes, even in other airports, not just in our Air Force Base airports, but they're a very important constituent of airplane fires.
What do we know about the health risks from PFCs?
Well, that's an ongoing study. There's not a lot that is known at this point. Everything is kind of speculative. There are studies by various federal agencies. At this point, it's primarily animal studies. As far as known human risks, depending on what levels, in long term, there's not very much that is known at all.
So what kind of level of contamination are we talking about? Does this exceed federal guidelines?
Most of the samples have not. They're measured in parts per trillion, and 70 parts per trillion is the current EPA cutoff point, but it's just a number at this point because, once again, we don't know the risks and at what levels. So at this point, we don't know exactly what the outcomes may be of this, but they're using that as a guideline at this point, and, you know, that could change at some point in the future.
There have been some newspaper reports that some of the residents in the area are concerned that health problems they're having, particularly thyroid health problems, might be attributable to the PFCs. Is there any way knowing whether those are connected?
No, not at this point, because, again, the studies aren't to a level where they can really fully understand the health effects, and so there's no way of really knowing that at this point.
For people whose wells might be contaminated with PFCs, what are you recommending?
Well, there's a couple of different options for those people, and one of them would be to put in an RO system. It's called a reverse osmosis system, and that's basically a filtering system to take out any contaminants, not only drop the levels of PFCs, but a lot of other contaminates. People use those in wells for other reasons. And they can also get a water cooler in their home if they wish to go that route.
Sure, bottled water. I mean, mm-hmm. We're familiar with that in Michigan.
Oh, yes.
So what is the Air Force doing about this contamination?
Well, they're working with our state agencies in trying to resolve this issue. It's going to take quite a bit of time yet because we're still following and doing testing on the groundwater and where that plume is exactly ending. It has been spreading over the course of time.
What can state regulators actually do? Can they force the Air Force to do something about this, monitor it, clean it up?
Well, monitoring it, yes. Cleaning up could be a very difficult thing to do because we're talking, again, parts per trillion, and we're talking a very large area. But one of the things that we're looking at, and fortunately for the people in that area, there's municipal water available. And so we're looking at possibility of hooking up people to municipal water, which would resolve that issue with the wells.
Is the Air Force working with the local community in any way to try to resolve this issue?
Well, quite some years ago, Lester, there was what was called a Restoration Advisory Board, or an RAB, at the Air Force Base, and they had stopped utilizing that quite a few years ago for lack of interest, I believe. And they are going to reestablish that. And what that consists of is all your local community governmental agencies, like the health department, like the townships involved, as well as citizens and other groups will be involved with this. And that'll be starting up soon. And so that'll be a good way of having some immediate communication with local residents and the officials that are involved with this.
Now, this is not the only chemical associated with the base. There's also trichloroethylene, or TCE. What's that from?
Well, once again, the trichloroethylene, you know, they use that in dry cleaners. They use that in other purposes. And I'm not sure where on the Air Force Base that may have originated. It could have been from dry cleaning, but I'm not sure.
As I understand it, in the reports I've seen, it seems like it was used for basically degreasing engine parts.
Cleaning. That's another cleaning purpose, sure.
So I understand most of this contamination is limited to private wells, but I also understand there's an advisory not to eat the fish in a section of the Aucoupil River. Tell me about that.
There's a small almost like a marshy lake near the Air Force base, that they're recommending that the fish not be eaten in there. Migratory fish that come and go, just like anything else with contaminants, are not so much a problem. But bottom feeders, certain bottom feeders like catfish and carp and so forth, are the ones that are of concern. And those are the ones that they're recommending that people not eat.
Beyond what we've talked about, getting reverse osmosis water filters or getting bottled water into the house, what else are you recommending, and what are you telling your residents?
Well, once again, we're telling them that this is going to be an ongoing program, and we're working on the state and the federal government. We're working on funding for possible hookups to municipal water, and that we will continue monitoring this issue, and as well as immediate action, of course, as we mentioned earlier. Continue to drink either the water cooler, bottled water, or utilize the reverse osmosis process.
Chuck LaShawn is Deputy Health Officer and Environmental Health Director for a four-county area, which includes the site of the former Wurtsmith Air Force Base near Oscoda. Thanks for telling us about this.
Thanks, Lester, for having me on.
Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening.